The Alabama Crops Report Podcast, your trusted information source for Alabama agriculture.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of the Alabama Crops Report Podcast. Today in the studio, we've got a good group of folks here. Starting off with myself, we got Blake Lanton, and we've got Dr. Scott Graham joining us today. How are y'all guys this morning?
We're good. And Jacob's over there, too.
Jacob's the man here.
I'm always tucked away in the corner running the soundboard, but today I got a mic, so I'm dangerous today.
Well, we couldn't do it without you. I don't want no part of that board.
Oh, it ain't too bad. I'm glad to be here, though. Glad to kind of listen in on a good talk today.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, Scott, what's the hot topic of discussion for today?
I guess it's the elephant in every room you walk in.
How cold it is outside?
Well,
the weather?
Beside that, you know.
Been a little bit of interesting cotton jacet, two-spot cotton leafhopper this year across the lower southeast. Ended up being a pretty big deal. We didn't know. We knew about it potentially being here in the spring last year, but weren't overly concerned about it, Blake. We even found it on the experiment station at E.V. Smith near Tallahassee in June last year. Found it in Headland on the experiment station in June. And Jacob, I didn't say anything about it. Didn't think it was going to be a big deal.
And Lord, did it turn out to be a big deal.
Turned into a big deal. It did. At least for the people who had it, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Josh, you started, what was your first day?
First official date was August the 8th.
August the 8th.
And I remember going with you riding. I think we went to Bruton, and that was the first time I looked down. I think that was week two on the job.
Yeah, that's about right, probably, yeah. Yep. I got first phone call of a commercial field on August the 12th. That was Jackson County, Florida, about 6 miles south of Dothan, or south of the state line, I should say. And then August the 13th, the next day, was the first commercial field confirmed in Alabama, and before we knew it, it was in 75% of the counties that grew cotton this year in Alabama.
Yep.
As far north as Limestone County, Tennessee state line.
So two things come out of that. We hire a new cotton specialist from Georgia, we get a brand new invasive insect, and we also have the highest yield on record this year. So
yep, we do.
We'll blame Josh for the insect, and I'll take credit.
And you're gonna
for
take the yield.
I'll take credit for the yield. Mm. All that extra plant bug sprays we made cleaning up jacets.
Yep.
So this insect is very small. It's like a millimeter or 2 millimeters. They're green. They're hard to distinguish from other leafhopper species. You think about potato leaf hopper, we get in peanuts and that kind of stuff. They look similar, but the adults have two black spots on the wings. And so that's how we positively identify the adults. One thing that's interesting about them, and I made a joke about how cold it is out there, is they don't overwinter, or they survive the winter, but they don't diapause. Jacob, that's an entomological word that essentially means hibernate.
Gotcha.
So they don't go dormant in the winter and wait until it warms up to come back out and feed. They're active all year long.
Wow.
Just where they're from, that's how they're adapted. And so we don't know right now what they're on or how active they are. But what we do know is last year we had a couple of pretty cold snaps, right, if you remember. Snowed on the beach last year in Florida. This insect was essentially at undetectable levels, Josh. It was found in Jackson County, Florida. Like one of them was found in October.
Mm-hmm.
And we had it this year exploded. So we're pretty confident it's going to be back this year. I was talking with Philip Roberts at the University of Georgia this morning. And, you know, I keep hearing people telling me, well, Dr. Roberts said that 2025 is the worst cotton, is the best the cotton jacet situation is ever going to be. And I told him, I said, you know, Philip, I was thinking about it, and you may be right, but I got news for the jacet. It's the worst we're ever going to be.
That's right.
It kind of caught us somewhat surprised this year, and we still did a pretty good job on it. And we know a lot more now, and we're prepared for it. So
it's game on.
It's game on.
We're
now.
Gonna grow cotton.
That's right. Game on. That's right.
Well, going back to, you know, talking about it overwintering and throwing out big words. So polyphagous was the word that I learned yesterday. So I think Isaac said they feed on 25 plant species over 15 different families.
Yeah, well, that's what their reported host range is. Yeah, and so what we don't know is how many of those plants are true hosts that they can feed, reproduce on, and how many of them are what you might call an incidental host that they just happen to be on. Trying to find my list here. I don't have it on this set of notes. But we saw them for sure feed and reproduce in cotton, in okra, eggplant.
Hibiscus is obviously a big one. I keep hearing that thrown out there.
Hibiscus and sunflower. So we know that those for sure, we know they can cause damage on and reproduce in. What we don't have a clue about right now is what are they going to be on in the winter, because they don't have a winter in India. This insect is native to India. I don't know if I said that before. We had a meeting with Cotton Incorporated set up with some really top-notch researchers from over there. And when I asked them, what should we be looking at, they said, well, honestly, we don't know. And I was like, what do you mean you don't know? It's what I was thinking. And then as the conversation went on with them and this conference call we had, I slowly realized they don't have a winter in India. So how would they know? Why would they know? So that's just something we're going to have to learn. And we've got cover crops out there, right, Josh? Chandler's right. Got – he's got sticky traps, sticky cards out. Yep, so we'll see those. See if we find anything there.
Well, our cover crops, I'm not going to say they've been slow growing, but they've been quick to establish. But nothing's really tall enough yet to go out there and us actually, you know, scout.
That's right,
it.
Yeah.
So I would think in the next, you know, 30 days, 45 days – 1st of March, hopefully we'll be able to at least go out there and see a presence or absence.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. You know, that's what I tell people. You get kind of, I don't know if embarrassed is the right word, but you keep getting asked all these questions, and your answer is kind of like an agronomist answer, Jacob. It's, I don't know.
It depends.
It depends. So.
At least they get to say it depends. For us right now, it's truly, I don't know. And we're going to know a lot more in March and April, Blake, to your point, than we know on January the 28th as we sit today.
And I would assume that's going to be, you know, weather temperature dependent. If we have a, you know, a really warm February like we have had in some years, I would assume populations would be more rapidly growing.
You would think so, yeah. They'll start to build up numbers quicker.
But that hive 29 that's coming this weekend hopefully is in our favor.
We're
just grit our teeth and not complain.
See what happens, yeah. I hope they don't bunker down too low.
Yeah. So we know that as of the end of the year, they have been found all the way from East Georgia to East Texas and up through the Carolinas.
Yep, and far north, the Carolinas, and then one county in Tennessee. They were found on the experiment station in Jackson, Tennessee, so that's Madison County.
And again, we came from a very small bubble in Florida last year, and they spread that fast. So
they were
able to survive possibly every cotton-producing state this year, has the potential to have them.
So, yeah. They were essentially undetectable in 24, and we saw what happened in 25. So now that they were certainly detectable in 25, we'll see what happens in 26. Yes, that's a good point. So when we had that conversation with the folks from India, we asked them, where should we expect them to survive? And they said, their answer was, after we kind of had to poke them a little bit, was anywhere you find them this year, they'll be there next year. But then later on in the conversation, they made the point that in northern India, they have much less pressure than they do in central and southern India. Well, if you look on a map and look at the longitude, correct, that's the east and west one.
Sure.
I think that's right. Yeah, Jacob's nodding his head.
I think so. I'm
horizontal
sure.
lines.
That's right. If you look at that, northern India lines up with the panhandle of Florida. And so that's already kind of their, you know, that's the northern range of where they have issues in India. And then you consider we're above that even. So I'm hoping it will be slower to develop. I'm hoping it'll be a mid-bloom pest, Josh, at best.
I hope.
Or, you know, yeah. If this year is normal, we'll be all right. We manage it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, so what are some things maybe you observed, though, last year that maybe some folks had a heavier infestation of the jacid and others didn't, and maybe what were some of the practices, though?
That's a great question. So initially, populations were highest on early planted cotton, which was probably means they were there at low levels for most of the year, and they just blew up in August, right? It's probably what that means. But the issues where we may have had problems with yield loss, the impacts were much greater in the later planted cotton. And the thing there basically is that the jacid in the late planted cotton, the jacid showed up earlier in the cotton's life, right? So it was like pre-bloom or maybe just starting to bloom when the jacid started building. Whereas in the early planted cotton that had maybe more pressure, the cotton was mid-bloom or later when they started developing. And so it just wasn't as much time for the jacids to cause problems, right?
Gotcha.
And so that's still going to be one of my recommendations this year for folks in South Alabama. If you're concerned about jacid, is plant earlier. Josh, I've been picking April the 15th as my go date.
Yep. And as long as you got enough growing degree units, enough heat.
If you got moisture. If you got moisture and the next 6 days look good, yep. Let's stick some cotton in the ground and try to get as much season behind us as we can before the jacids start to build.
Well, and that's one of the things that Dr. Brown kind of backtracked towards the end of his career. It was always, soil temperature, and then – I think he finally decided that it's soil moisture that
you got to have both.
You got to have temperature, oxygen, and moisture for development. And I tell y'all, one of the good tools, there's a bunch of tools to use, but one is a planting calculator. It's out of North Carolina State University. It basically gives you a forecast, you know, based on your actual farm location on when to plant cotton and when the best time is to plant. It'll give you rank it from good to poor planting conditions. So before you put that seed in the ground, if you've got a question on, am I going to have enough higher temps, that kind of stuff, that's a good tool just to use to give peace of mind and make sure that you're planting, into good, adequate soil, good temperatures. You know, we want to try and avoid a replant at all cost.
Yeah, and it's very similar, that model is, to their Thrips model that they
correct.
Have. So folks should hopefully
– right.
We've been talking about it for six, yes. 7, 8 years now, so yep. Hopefully people are familiar
yep.
with that system.
That is exactly right.
But then something else that the literature backs up and we observed as well is that weaker fields, particularly with potash, seem to crash quicker. So if you don't have necessary potash, that's very important for boll fill, obviously, and probably some other stuff. But fields that had some stemphylium and that kind of stuff, which is a good indicator of low potassium, they were not able to fight off the hopper burn as well. So that's something else that's important.
So, right. Yeah, I guess going back to that, sitting in our Cotton Commission meeting the other day, Audrey Gamble threw her slides up there with the Kohler's rotation and old rotation. And where there's no potassium put at Kohler's, you get a zero on lint yield.
Mm-hmm.
And at old rotation, there's been cotton grown in the same plot for 100 years. No nitrogen put on it, it's still picking like a bale. So, again, this is theory, but you've got really good data on stink bugs and plant bugs that they like high nitrogen fields or plants that's got a lot of nitrogen. So in today's world, we're trying to cut back on everything. So I think there's enough information there that do not cut back on your potassium. If you're going to cut back on anything, cut back on your nitrogen. I think we can safely say that.
Yeah, and you know that you still gotta have enough nitrogen.
Oh yeah, yeah.
For
I'm not saying
yield potential, but I think we're probably cutting back on that stuff anyway. But yeah, don't just put an extra 20 units because
yeah,
just you know, it's not the time for that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We want good, proper fertility, Blake. You know, like you said, we got to set the crop up for success. You know, a healthy crop is going to be able to combat if you have had high acid pressure versus a plant that's already susceptible, you know, to low potassium, low fertility, you know, poor drainage, that kind of stuff. So remember, you know, we want to have input costs as low as we can, but we don't want to rob ourselves of yield potential just because we're wanting to cut corners on something.
Yeah.
You know, make sure we get a healthy stand.
Yeah. And something else, Jacob, to your original question that we found is pretty impactful is leaf hairiness. And so there's basically very little hairy cotton, truly hairy cotton in the system, in the southeast at least, anymore. But we do have smooth varieties and semi-smooth varieties. And Josh Mike could talk about what that means. But essentially what we've observed is that even having a semi-smooth leaf, we see significantly lower jacid populations than a smooth leaf. And so the opposite is true for silverleaf whitefly, if you're in that part of the world and you're concerned about them. But with all the unknowns we have right now, Josh, the devil I know, the devil I don't, and I know whiteflies, right? I know I can handle them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the materials that we found that controlled jacid also have pretty good whitefly activity. But yeah, I think that semi-smooth variety might be another easy option that's not going to cost you any extra money that can help fight them.
Sure. And there's several varieties that are available that are the semi-smooth leaf type. And, you know, one of the questions, you know, comes up is, well, how do I know if one's smooth or semi-smooth? And that question comes, you can ask your seed retailer. That information will be provided, or you can go, like, if you're looking at whatever given, you know, variety, take your pick, you can go on that website and it'll have a list of all the agronomic information on there, and it will state the leaf type on there, either smooth or semi-smooth right now.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so now we've kind of answered that question. So the next question is, you got them in your field. What's the tactics? What kind of tools is available for producers to use at this moment that you know has worked?
Well, first of all, I'll say Jacob might just need to be our
Jacob
new host.
Jacob needs to be the host. I think,
we're going to start just giving him a microphone.
He's on top of it.
Hey, I told y'all I'm dangerous today. Yeah. I got a mic in front of me.
So. Simmer's not here, so
that's right.
We're just going to let Jacob cook a little bit. So that's a great, great question. So first thing is scouting, and yep. We don't know necessarily if what we did last year is the best way to do it, if that's how we're going to finish up doing it. But we needed to have something easy to do, B, easy to explain. And so that way when people call and they tell us what their pressure or populations are, we're all on the same page. And so what we went with last year based on just kind of quick observations early on in the deal was to look at the main stem leaf, four nodes from the terminal. So start at the terminal, go four nodes down. I like to say that's right there where you're looking for PGR decisions, Josh.
Right.
Right, between the fourth and the fifth. Mm-hmm. So that's a familiar zone of the plant to go to for most people. Flip that leaf over and just look for jacids on the bottom of the leaf. Talked about earlier what they look like, and it's important to make sure on the adults you see those two black spots on the wings before you get overly excited, because I don't think a single cotton entomologist in America appreciated how many species of leafhoppers are in cotton fields until this thing started. It's unbelievable how many different leafhoppers are out there. And so it's important to see that, because the other ones cause no injury. And so you don't want to go out there and spray a non-pest, right? So that's very important to be sure you properly identify. Unfortunately, the immatures, we can't really confidently identify them. So we need to see adults and or some signs of injury in the field of hopper burn before we make any decisions. And hopper burn, I should also describe, starts off the leaves – will get a little bit of a, I call it a bronzing color, just looks a little off. And then you'll see yellowing along the leaf margins, the outside of the leaf. And then it'll turn red and eventually brown, which just means it's killed the leaf, and the leaves will fall off if left untreated. And it happens really fast, Josh. Like,
yes,
2 weeks, you can go from nice green field to crunchy.
Yes.
Goodness.
In 2 weeks. And so that makes timing this thing really, really important. To that end, when we looked at the literature from India, they had thresholds of anywhere from 1 to 5 per leaf. So we picked 5. Start at you know, we never even mentioned that publicly, I don't think. We saw enough stuff going on. We very quickly went to 3. And then by the end of it, in less than a month's time, we had dropped it down to 1 per leaf. And that's currently where we are. I think that's pretty good. Especially if you're able to make timely applications. But if I still think, you know, we have a lot of farmers in the state of Alabama that takes as much as 2 weeks to get the sprayer across everything. You can't be 2 weeks late on this pest.
Yeah.
And so I think in some situations we may have to go to a percent infested. And if you've got 50% of the leaves infested and you know it takes 10 days to get across everything, or in the next 5 days there's 85% chance of storms, you might go ahead and pull the trigger a little bit early just to make sure you intervene.
Mm-hmm. Most of what the thresholds we're talking about is a little bit taller cotton. We still
don't know about if it gets in the younger cotton what it's going to look like. That's true. Something else important, Blake, are these indicator plants we talk about, right? And so, you know, a lot of times, especially in no-till fields, you'll see random plants, cotton plants, that are 5 or 10 feet away from the rest of the field. For some reason, they like to get on those plants first. And they will show you on that plant what's about to happen to the border, the first 20 or 30 feet of the field. And then they'll show you what's going to happen to the entire field. That's part of why it didn't take a lot of convincing to get people in the southeast to spray for this insect this year, because they saw those indicator plants and on field borders what was about to happen. But so we can use those plants as kind of our key scouting area. And until you start seeing jacids or hopper burn on those indicator plants, you're highly unlikely to have them across the rest of the field. So that is one positive. We can use those as places to start, and then once we see an issue there, move into the field before we worry about scouting the entire field.
And then I kind of say this, you know, back when we were still scouting for bollworms, you know, generally a consultant had a scout, and they were in the field every 3 to 4 days. This is something, if, you know, nowadays, generally, people only look at fields once a week. If you got time, I'm not telling you, you know, check behind your scout, but go help him out a little bit, because this has the potential to get away from you in 3 to 5 days. Again, look for those indicator plants. If you can walk out, you don't have to go walk out in the middle of the field. Just scouting these borders, we don't know how big the pressure is going to be, but any and all help.
That's right.
Is going to help you in the end.
And let's say this too, Blake, while I'm thinking about it. I'm just pulling up my map of the great state of Alabama to confirm. I don't know that we had any sprays really north of Highway 80 this year, and very few that far north. If they were, they were just in that corridor, right? You probably were involved with
– Yeah, there were a couple. There were 2 fields. They were really, really late planted cotton. One was a replanted field. The other field really just had more plant bugs that needed getting out of there. So we just changed chemistry to take care of both.
And so we found them in, like I said, you know, as far north as Cherokee and Limestone counties. But I don't think we sprayed anything essentially north of Montgomery for them this year. And the majority of what we sprayed was, probably, honestly, south of Enterprise, Andalusia, going that way. So that's, you know, a lot of what we're talking about is probably much more important for South Alabama, true South Alabama, or LA as they call it, Josh, lower Alabama, than it is for Central and North Alabama. But we need to be watching for them.
And I think another thing we need to touch on is their reproductive rate's really fast. So
yeah, so that they can go through a generation in 2 weeks.
So and changing up chemistries, you know, not giving them anything to build resistance.
That's right. And, you know, I always hesitate to talk about insecticides and those types of things on these formats. I will say I'm working right now on updating the control guide with everything that has a 2EE as of now. Hopefully we'll be able to edit it in season as things change. But, you know, since this is an invasive pest, it's not on anybody's label. And so we're going to have to get special exemptions, which I don't expect to be a problem for anything that works. But one thing I am very comfortable saying is bifenthrin ain't the answer.
Yeah.
Does not work.
Yeah.
We spray a lot of other pyrethroids as well. Pyrethroids in general are like throwing a match on gasoline with this insect. And so.
Yeah, I think you've got some data that where bifenthrin was sprayed versus the control, they increase.
A couple of my plots, there was like 20% more in the bifenthrin plots at 4 days after than there was in the check plots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Part of that might be knocking out beneficials and seeing what, you know, is probably part of it. I don't know. But that is a very, very important thing. I always say at the county meetings, if you remember nothing else that I said, remember bifenthrin does not control cotton jacids. One other thing I'd like to mention, I got on one of these AI models, Microsoft Copilot to be exact. That's the one Auburn has a license with. And I took a very, very in-depth literature review of cotton jacid, put it in the system, and I said, only use this as your reference. I wanted to make sure we were getting legitimate sources, right, and not Facebook and TikTok giving their opinion. And I said, where do you think cotton jacid is most likely to overwinter in Alabama and in Georgia? And I think I could probably do a pretty good guess for Florida as well. And it essentially said on the coastal areas. So East Georgia, Southwest Alabama is where. So I would guess anywhere along the panhandle's got some coastal area, right? So there's something about that microclimate, just a little bit warmer, I guess, that it thinks it's going to have a greater chance of survival. Now, it still had a good chance in Southeast Alabama and West Georgia, Southwest Georgia as well. But those are probably areas that they're going to be starting first this year.
I think you said humidity plays a role in there.
Yeah, humidity plays a role in the summer anyway, and certainly temperatures do. But so
you would think that those two, you know, the Southwest is around Mobile Bay, like you said, coastal,
yep.
East Georgia, you got a good bit of humidity there all year.
That's right, yeah. So that could play a role. You know, the worst infestations and worst fields in the country this year, it's always fun to say the country, you know, it's just, it was only in really four or five states, really. But it started in East Georgia. Which, Josh, you're from Georgia.
Nope.
That's not where all the cotton is.
No. Mm-mm.
And so we were thinking, and probably still not wrong, Hurricane Helene in 2024 brought them up from South Florida. And Helene ended up going up the East Coast into South Carolina. And, in fact, the first experiment trial sprayed in the U.S. was in South Carolina, interestingly. But we were thinking maybe Helene dumped them off there and then they spread. And there's probably some truth to that. But then now we also, based on that AI model, that just could have been where they overwintered better. They just survived there better. So we don't know. It's pretty interesting, though.
Well, you know, kind of wrap this up. Going back, you know, at one point we updated the Cotton Commission on this. And I know me and you had several conversations where we were trying – to imagine what life was going to be like without cotton. We thought this may be the end. So from there to now, how, you know, How much confidence do you have in going forward? And again, I know this is all theory, but I think at the end when that cotton we had in Prattville that I planted on September 10th, I know one day we said, I don't know what we learned, but we learned something. We'll talk about it on the drive home.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty optimistic right now, at least in terms of our ability to continue to produce a crop. I won't get into the economics and markets and outlooks and all that stuff.
But we can keep it alive.
But I think we can still, with this pest in the system, I'm still confident that we can manage it in such a way that it's not a reason to not grow cotton.
Yeah, yeah. Again, there's going to be some pockets where if they get on early, it's going to be really tough.
Well, and so a good place to end this, I think, is that in the spring of 96, when BT Cotton was coming out, Ron in the county meetings said, based on 95, he said, grow BT cotton or plant soybeans. And Alabama planted 77% of the acres, Jacob, in 1996 into BT cotton.
Holy
That's how bad the worms were in 95. I said, I'm not to the point of saying plant soybeans, but what I am saying is you got to have a scout.
Yeah.
You cannot do this without a scout. You can't do it on a calendar. You can't do it from the windshield when you're spraying herbicides or PGRs. You've got to have boots in the ground weekly that know what they're doing, know what they're looking for, and you've got to be prepared to treat when necessary. We're still working on that note. We're still working on finalizing our scout school dates, and we'll get that out as soon as we can. But we're going to have great, great focus on scouting for cotton jacet this year.
Yep.
For sure. All righty, guys. Well, I'm going to close this up. Are there any last remarks, anything y'all want to say before we close out? All right, guys. Well, thank y'all so much for joining us with the Alabama Crops Report podcast. We look forward to seeing y'all soon.
The Alabama Crops Report is a production of the Alabama Cooperative Extension System.